Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue, and what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and bouting, having the very conversations that you hear on my show, and working with my clients, which include chefs, somms, big brands, startups, all those doing what's most delicious and innovative. Today's in-studio guest, hashtag people we like, will welcome Anita Lowe, chef owner of Anissa in the West Village. She was on Top Chef Masters in its first season, finished as a finalist, raised money for charity. Maybe most importantly to me, she's the maker of some of the most memorable eating in New York City. Think foie gras dumplings, foie gras soup dumplings, excuse me, big difference. Miso marinated sable with crispy silken tofu in bonito broth. Love it. It's just a fusion. I'm going to use the dirty word fusion, but an American food that is influenced by her Malaysian Chinese upbringing. That makes so much sense. We'll talk about some of her recent travels to Senegal, Russia, Alaska, and about finding a chef's identity. But before catching up with Anita, we'll drop by the Green Market with Nicole Ponseca, owner of Maharlika and Jeepney Filipino restaurants, and see what's caught her eye. After Anita, to wind it down, we'll talk wine and umami with a regular on Word of Mouth, because he's such a nerd, Ali Bouzari, culinary scientist who works with the likes of the French Laundry and the CIA. That's the culinary one. So it's off to the Green Market to seek some January cleanse-worthy inspiration in sunflower greens. I'm at the Union Square Green Market with Nicole Ponseca, owner of Maharlika and Jeepney, two very well-loved Filipino restaurants in the East Village.
Oh, salamat. Thank you.
I love your food.
Thank you.
So we are standing at Greener Pastures, also known as the Union Square Grassman. And you just look for them. They're always the stand is always set up in front of a big yellow bus. Lots of gorgeous baby greens here. We're having a hard time deciding on Nicole. What's catching Nicole's eye? Let's see. We've got the sweet pea shoots here. I'm gonna taste that too. Okay. More familiar. You know, that's a more common ingredient found in...
Really grassy. Almost similar to like clean, crisp water flavor of celery.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the bang is with the baby sunflower seeds.
Sunflower greens,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So they hold up really well when you cook or you eat them raw in a salad or sandwich. And if you were to ask me how to describe the flavor... Right?
How does it look?
It's a long, light green stem,
mm-hmm.
And at the end is a clover, and it's like a two-leaf clover.
Two-leaf clover.
And it's strong. It's a really sturdy leaf. It's not like a clover you'd find in the grass. It's pretty dense.
Yeah, it's like a thick. It's like a thick, like meaty leaf.
Yeah. It's about, half an inch long.
At least the ones we're seeing here.
Yeah. And I ran into this green first at Caravan of Dreams. And they had it in their Thai lover salad so many years ago. And I've always order that salad when I go
what
there.
What is just Caravan of Dreams?
Caravan of Dreams is a vegan restaurant. It's on 5th, between 1st and A. It's been there maybe 20 years or more. And when it first opened, it was pretty quiet. And it's similar to like Angelica's, but a little bit more grittier.
Got it.
A little bit more East Village. And now it's always packed. I mean, we were going there many years, and now so many more vegans or people interested in a plant-based diet. So the sunflower greens really is, if you taste the leaf, really tastes like the sunflower seed.
Okay.
And then, of course, crossed with the greens, it has that fresh herbaceousness to it. Feels really clean.
Yeah.
But it's a hearty green.
It's so good.
It's so good.
I could eat this entire tray of it.
Right, so Matt, you compare this even with like baby anchovies, whether canned or packed in a jar. Stir-fried is really awesome. Imagine this stir-fried with mushrooms, and it's an amazing vegetable. I'm really into it.
The baby sunflower greens are an indulgence for Nicole and me at home, but you also use the pea shoots on one of your dishes.
Yeah, we have the pea shoots at Maharlika, and it's served with a coconut and bagoong sauce.
Okay.
And bagoong is a fermented shrimp sauce. It's really pungent, super salty, a very strong baby shrimp flavor. So it's that concentrated flavor mixed with coconut milk. And it's so Filipino. And
that sounds so good.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of flavor and combination I don't see very much in restaurants using the shrimp paste with coconut, right? It's always usually coconut and ginger, coconut and galangal or lemongrass. So when you serve it with the shrimp paste and then the greens, it's a wonderful meal on its own with some fragrant garlic rice. It's awesome.
Garlic what?
Garlic rice.
Garlic rice, okay.
Yeah, the staple in the Philippines.
So is that the dish on right now?
We have it sautéed pea shoots with coconut milk, bagoong, and tiger prawns.
Okay, so it's a bed under which the tiger prawns hang out?
Yeah, exactly. They hang out in the pool of coconut milk together.
And pea shoots and shrimpy paste.
Yeah, exactly.
Ugh, I want to be a tiger prawn. Right at the moment, at this moment.
That's going to be your James Bond name.
Tiger prawn. Or add it with my street name. It could be more than a James Bond name.
So you're going to be your graffiti tag, Tiger Pond.
I grew up on Sunny Canyon Lane, so.
So that's your porn name?
Yeah. So is it like Tiger Pond, Sunny Canyon, Tiger Pond?
Something like that. This is going all places right now.
Thank you so much for coming out here today.
Sure, thank you.
Welcome back to the studio. I'm your host, Lei Tisu, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lei Tisu on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And now, before we introduce our in-studio guest, I'm going to provide some social media info. Hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW, at Lei Tisu, LEITISU, at Heritage_radio, and at Anita Lowe, ANITALONYC, because there must have been another Anita Lowe. Darn her. And now for people we like.
People we like!
Anita Lowe, welcome!
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'll just be like super, super geeky and say that, you know, before I went into the food industry, I went to the Vendy Awards a couple years in a row because that's so my jam, street food. And, you know, I guess you were a judge.
Yeah, one year. Like, yeah, that was fun.
I was just like, I mean, just was and is a huge fan of Anissa. And sheesh, and you've been through a restaurant fire and now you have an upcoming knee surgery, and then you've braved the second coming of the polar vortex to be here.
I did make it though.
We were both struggling in the subways today. There was not to be a cab or an Uber to be found.
Oh my God, I'm usually very much like exactly on time. That was a little scary for me, but here we are.
So 13 years in having your own restaurant. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's like like that's like 100 years old in people time.
Right, exactly. Just like dog years.
Well, I don't know, I'll start off. How was your weekend?
It was lovely. I went to Amanda Freitag's new restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was really, really fun. The space is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Empire Diner.
Nice. Okay. So, friends and family?
No, I think they've been open for about a week now. Mm-hmm. I went with a bunch of other chef friends. Mm-hmm. Amanda Cohen, Heather Carlucci, mm-hmm. My chef de cuisine, Mary Atia. Mm-hmm.
So you've been on some fun travels recently.
Yes, lots of fun travels.
Was Senegal, Alaska, and Russia?
Yes, I was in Moscow. I was cooking in Moscow this, when was that? I've done so many trips in the past 3 years. I was doing like one every other month for at least 3 years, yeah.
Okay, so favorite destination?
Oh, gosh. I mean, all of them were, you know, really eye-opening and gorgeous, gorgeous countries. I must say that Alaska was extraordinary. It was just breathtakingly beautiful, and we were fishing every day, which is one of the things that I adore. I'm obsessed with, and the fisheries up there are so plentiful, mm-hmm. and yeah, you can't really drop a line without bringing something up, and it's
So it's good for beginners.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, I mean, sometimes you're going to be bringing up a 100-pound halibut. You know, so you got to be strong, or you got to know a little bit what you're doing if you're going to land that thing. But
really, be like, ah, someone help, take this from me.
You know, and we were like fishing, and there were whales. Like, sounding, like, all around us.
Yeah.
Like, multiple whales. It was really incredible.
Wow. I learned recently, you know, we chatted, and your dream job, if you weren't to be a chef, would it be a travel writer?
Yes, I would love that. I would, you know, I'd have to go back to school and learn a little bit more about writing, but I am just passionate about seeing other cultures and you know, eating my way through other countries.
So. Well, you'd have to learn more about writing. And by the way, I just want to compliment you on your very pithy response to Gods of Food in the New York Times.
Oh, thank you.
You wrote that yourself, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay, yeah. That was awesome. I think there's hope for that as your second career.
Okay, thank you.
check it out if you haven't read it yet. Travel tips, like, let's talk to you as a travel writer right now. Like, if I were going to one of these incredible countries that you've been to recently, where should I eat? Like, what's kind of like a not as known tip or trick or you know, favorite restaurants?
Let's see. Well, it's hard to say, because I was on these trips, and they were organized by they're organized by other people, so I didn't do like a ton of research beforehand. Mm-hmm. It was but yeah, I mean my biggest tip is to do as much research as possible beforehand. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you can connect with somebody that lives in that country or has been to that country before, that's always the best. I mean I was very fortunate to be shown around by, you know, people that live in these countries.
Right.
And it was great to be also working in these countries, but, you
right.
know, to see the inside of it.
Yeah, and you're sort of discovering what ingredients are available to you in Senegal or even Cuba.
Oh, yeah. Cuba last year was really cool. That was one of the most interesting projects I've ever done.
So. Well, what did you go down there for?
There were 10 of us. It was a cultural exchange, so we actually went to the country legally.
Legally, yes.
Legally, yeah. And so 10 chefs paired with 10 Cuban chefs, and an architect had built a pop-up restaurant.
Ooh.
And out of shipping containers.
Wow.
And for every guest that we each took a night to cook, and for every there was one Cuban invited for every paying guest, because the Cubans aren't really allowed to they don't have that buying power to eat there. So it was more like a dialogue.
Okay.
Really, really cool.
So what kind of Cubans, were they sort of like writers or food people, or who got to come to this awesome dinner party?
A lot of different people. I mean, I think it was everyone from like the, and I don't speak Spanish that well, so I didn't really get to speak to them, but there were construction workers, all walks of life. So
okay.
I think it was really, really interesting. I was obviously cooking at the time, so I didn't actually get to talk to many of the guests.
What kind of dishes did you sort of come up with?
I made a sailfish, and it was so hard to get fish there. It was like buying drugs. Like it was really interesting. Like we had to go down and have this meeting like near this marina. We weren't even really allowed into the. They didn't trust us, so I had to like wait outside of this marina until finally they let me in. And we got this gorgeous sailfish, which I'm not even quite sure. I grilled that with. It was hard to find ingredients on it. There weren't a ton of ingredients, but we did visit farms there. Yeah, it was really fantastic.
They just didn't want to do business, right? Given the environment, they're like, "You're like, I want to give you money for what you have to offer."
Well, I don't know. When I was in China, there were two different currencies. So there's two.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Like, there's two different currencies in Cuba. So
okay,
there's like the tourist currency, and then there's the currency that the Cubans use.
Because pardon my lack of knowledge about Cuban fish and produce and ingredient availability, but it's kind of an island, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm now just sometimes on air, you're like, let me just doubt my knowledge of geography, that, the last class I took in geography was, like, in the
seventh
grade.
I'm getting to that age where I doubt, like, everything that my memory is just going, so.
New York City, New York City food when you first started cooking, and then when you opened up Anissa. And then now, what are sort of the big differences and similarities? Maybe kind of paint the picture, just because you've now seen so many eras. What was it like when you first started, and what was it like when you opened?
100 years in restaurant time, in people time. When I first started cooking, it was in fine dining. It was very Franco-centric.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how I got into cooking. I was studying French at the time, and ended up going to work for David Boulay. Then when I opened Anissa, I think, and things were really, really fancy when I first started.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the greatest restaurants were all, you had to wear a jacket, and men had to wear a jacket, etc. When I opened Anissa, I think there was it was more of there were a lot of chefs that were opening personal restaurants, a little bit more casual,
mm-hmm.
Contemporary American, very personal cuisines, like very focused on creativity,
just like Wiley and Blue Hill folks. Valsey.
Yeah, a lot of different Marco's restaurant, Tocqueville, and those were all people of my generation, I feel. I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on right now. although I do eat out every weekend. I eat out every weekend to all the new places.
I'm glad that you can now get the time off. to do so.
You have to. You have to. It's just to stay current. It's really important to know what's going on in the industry.
Mm-hmm. So have you been to, like, I don't know, I'm throwing out some of my personal favorites, Fung Tu, Kyo.
I haven't been to Fung Tu. We were talking about that yesterday. I wanted to ask you, Jonathan Wu, I think he was my intern at one point.
Seriously?
Is he like a sort of taller
Asian fellow?
Guy with like big, thick black glasses?
I'm not sure if he wears contacts, and then that's why, you know, because I'm sure glasses aren't... Are glasses like okay in the kitchen? I mean...
Yeah, maybe not, yeah.
But he... Maybe he has contacts, but he is a taller Asian guy.
Yeah.
And he used to work at Per Se.
Okay, yeah, I think he used to be my intern. I have to go.
You would dig his food. Like, he... You know, he has just, like, for a starter, beautiful baby bok choy, and then the dip is, like, a shrimp paste he makes himself that is just, like, umami bomb. You know, he just, he talks about the whole process. He dehydrates the shrimp himself, smushes it up himself.
Cool.
It is the jam. And I tried to...
I bet
he finds some way to get it so that it's not sort of the stuff that... You know, my Chinese mother gets from, you know, he probably sources some incredible shrimp, and then that's just knowing him.
He's
obsessive, like every great chef.
Obsessive, compulsive.
I would love to know what you think after you go.
Yeah, I'm dying to go. It's definitely on my list. So,
well, I mean, I agree with you. Like fusion. I mean, that's such a dirty word. I'm going to stop using that word.
It's, you know, it shouldn't be a dirty word because what, you know, it really shouldn't be a dirty word. I think there's nothing wrong with fusion. I mean, everything is fusion.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you know, you started doing the New American with your own personal influence from, you know, your background of the people in your kitchen, and probably your travels, I bet, you know, it's...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I think, you know, American cuisine is certainly a fusion cuisine. I think all cuisines are fusion, so... but certainly in this country, which is an enormous country, and certainly in the urban centers, or where you find all walks of life from many, many different cultures, and then people like me who have very multicultural upbringings, you know, it just makes sense that it be a contemporary American be a fusion cuisine or a multicultural cuisine.
Absolutely. And I know you're a little bit against still finding our own chefy identity based on that Village Voice article kicker.
I'm sorry?
We'll come back after the break, Anita, and talk about your identity.
Uh-oh.
Via, you know, not as a woman chef, not as an a lesbian chef, not as a Chinese American chef, but as a whatever it is that you are, the mix of all those things. And I think we should start after the commercial break with your mom and with dating in NYC.
Okay.
You are listening to Tom Cruise on Word of Mouth with Lei T. Su. Only on the heritageradionetwork.org.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Welcome back to the studio. I'm Leti Sue. I'm your host on Word of Mouth with on Heritage Radio Network, and we're here with Anita Lowe, chef owner of Anissa, one of my personal favorite restaurants and chefs. So it's such an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
Your mom and dad, stepdad, what do they do for a living?
My mother passed away, but she was a doctor. She was a pathologist, a blood doctor, so she was a hematopathologist. And my stepfather was a fundraiser for the American Friends Service Committee, which is a nonprofit.
Did they cook?
My mom was a great cook. My stepfather, not so much.
He made a particular... we call it a broken beef. What was it again? Chip beef. Yes,
yeah, one thing that I remember him making. He made one thing, and he loved to eat. But he also passed away. But the one thing that he made was chip beef one day, and it was terrible. Oh my God, it was terrible. It was like shaved beef. In some sort of like brown sauce on a piece of white bread. I'm sure that could be really good.
I'm sure.
But he didn't make it quite so good.
And then your mom, she did cook, right?
Yeah, she made all sorts of different things.
Do you think that maybe you got it from your mom? Like, she does she have some sort of outlier XS talent?
You know, we're Chinese, so of course we're obsessed with food. I think it's just part of the culture. We traveled a lot, and I had various other influences in my life. Both my parents worked, so I had nannies.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Hungarian nanny who cooked for us. I had various African American nannies, et cetera. So.
This was in Michigan?
Yeah, in Birmingham, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit.
Okay. Your father passed away when you were, like, teeny tiny, right?
Yeah, when I was 3. And he was a doctor as well.
Did you know anything about his palate, or...?
He was from Shanghai.
Okay.
He apparently was a great cook, too.
Wow.
I don't remember him cooking, but... yeah, I mean, I certainly grew up with a lot of, I guess not a lot, but certainly grew up aware of different Shanghaiese
dishes.
Dishes, yeah.
How did you get into cooking?
I was studying French in college, and I had spent some time in Paris.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Here
in the city?
Yes. And, I had done the program Reed Hall over there, which was fantastic. And I really, really wanted to go back. And my sister had been living in Paris, and she had taken some cooking classes there. And I was learning how to cook for myself. I had, I had to because I was in college. And I was really enjoying it. And I decided to go back to Paris and take cooking, and I was hooked after that, and after I finished college, I went to work at Boulay.
Nice. So you've worked under some incredible chefs before you opened up your own place. I guess let's start with you. At what point did you, in your learning and in your development and as a cook to become a cook chef, a chef who is also a cook, at what point did you realize that you might have the chance to be great? If you just kept on working hard at it, like, at what point did you realize that you were starting to become a chef with, a true, potentially a chef? No?
When I knew I was going to be, I really loved my first job at Boulay. And we were working so many hours. It was, back in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I just adored it. I loved the camaraderie. I loved I love the precision. And of course, yeah, and I loved that, you know, people weren't afraid of food there. You know, I think I remember we were making kidneys and stuff like that, and I just really identified with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were eating it. You know, growing up in Michigan, and being Asian, you know, it just, I don't know, it really set you apart, like, you know, and I always felt, you know, when we were eating weird things, I think, you know, friends would always make you feel other, you know, but,
Other,
yeah.
Yeah. So, biggest learning from, you know, one of your many mentors. Like, I ask this because your food is so, like, creative, and I don't throw that word around. Like, you know, I only recently began to believe that I could be creative. You know, as an Asian kid, you know, I just went and got those perfect grades and did all the right things, and now I'm like, oh my God, I'm creative. I get to be creative.
Yeah.
People are going to pay me to be creative. I mean, it's like a privilege. And so I find that your food is both intellectually fascinating and then viscerally so, like, just damn good. So, you know, I'm just wondering where you find that within yourself, or where you find that from a mentor, from a particular learning.
I think, you know, everything, everyone's mentors, everyone's teachers, everyone's background forms are what form a chef. I don't know what particularly. Yeah, I mean, I think it's all important.
Mm-hmm.
Am I answering this question?
Oh, of course. No, you're absolutely answering it. Yeah. Is there one mentor in particular you'd like to talk about?
You know, I think the different. Yeah, I would say David Waltuck.
Okay.
Really, really taught me about flavor,
hmm.
You know, and just, you know, you have to taste everything, and yeah, and really just deliciousness. I think, you know, I mean, certainly David Boulay was instrumental in forming my ideas about ingredients. I mean, I think we were, you know, that was farm to table way before, you know, this mm-hmm. farm to table craze.
So what did Waltuck say about flavor? You know, sort of, that's such a funny thing to say. It's like all chefs are supposed to care about flavor. But
yeah, and I'm not saying that Boulay, I mean, that was great flavor as well. But I think...
How did he talk about it? And I'm learning something here too.
Yeah, I'm not quite... It wasn't that he talked about it, but it was more, you know, We did a lot of eating there. You know, we all sat down and had staff meal together, and they were great staff meals.
Okay.
You know, I learned a lot.
Learning opportunity staff meals.
Exactly. Yeah. Just, you know, you couldn't go to a French bistro back then and get, you know, like that was, it was so much better than anything you could buy. You know, it was so, you know, the sous chef and David would make all of the staff meals. And we were open 5 days a week. It was...
Goodness gracious.
It was really... You know, and sometimes we'd have wine with staff meal. It was really extraordinary.
He was really one of those, here, try this. Do you taste it? What do you taste? Like, to the bone. Like, that kind of... You know, that kind
of... No, he wasn't, like, a mentor in that way. But he would be like, yeah, here... I mean, and Boulay certainly said, here, taste this.
Of course.
But he forced you to, you know, taste everything... And, you know, make everything balanced and make, you know, like, yeah, you weren't allowed to really mix a salad without tasting it. And, you know, you weren't allowed to, you know, it just...
No autopilot.
Yeah, there was no autopilot.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Which I think is really important, you know, because if you don't taste it, you don't know.
And I like to then mention to... the folks that have not cooked in professional kitchens, which surprisingly is most of the population, which is that making the same dish again and again and again and again and again and again, it's really easy to go on autopilot.
It's not
all the glamorous stuff on TV.
Yeah.
It's really repetitive.
Yeah, well, not quite sure that stuff on TV is all that glamorous either. But, yeah.
or at least in the background. But yeah.
What was the most surprising thing about your TV competition, food competition show stints?
You know, I mean, I've always known that television is powerful, but I didn't really realize that how incredibly powerful it is. The restaurant Anissa burned down 2 weeks before Top Chef Masters aired for the first time, and then it took us 9 months to reopen. And I figure I had just lost that wave. But then when we reopened it, we were just filled with people like saying, "Oh, I saw you on Top Chef Masters. I saw you on Top Chef." And still people are coming in from that. that's amazing. And I realize that these things are rerunning, but oh my God.
Yeah. It's like you guys are it's like you're still stuck on that. No, it's it drives real business.
Yeah,
so that's just wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to hear that. Business. Well, let's get down to business, to the million-dollar question, which is that as a single straight woman in New York City in the food industry, things can get pretty gory in New York City dating. So, sheesh, like, what is it? I always wanted to ask this. Like, what's it like to be a chef owner who works crazy hours, finding the, I guess it would be like 5 to 7%, I think, of lesbian lesbians in the population of people? Like, how has it been, what's it like?
Oh my god. Well, I don't know. Most of my career I had a very, very long-term relationship, and a nine-year relationship, so I wasn't single that long in my career, but mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly it's very difficult. I always thought that I would meet somebody through a friend, which is the way most people meet. I mean, maybe nowadays people meet online.
Sure. Have you ever tried that before?
No, I haven't. When I was single, people kept on saying, "Oh, come on, let's, create a profile." I was like, I don't think I can do this. I'm 48 years old, so it didn't come naturally. But it's very difficult. I think you're working all the time, and you work weird hours. So to date somebody in the normal population is very difficult. It's like, well, can you meet me at 1 o'clock in the morning?
Not trying to be a creep ball.
Yeah, it's just exactly. But yeah, I mean, I'm dating somebody now that works in the industry.
So. Mm-hmm. And I know it's like, everyone knows everybody, so that's sometimes difficult to do. But then in the food biz, it's like you spend so much time in the food biz anyway, so that's what ends up happening.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you want to find somebody that has the same interests as you. And not that you can't find that in the regular population, but when I opened Anissa with my then partner, one of the driving reasons why we opened our own place, and there were many other reasons, but we're like, how else are we going to see each other? So and that actually became too much, but it was. It's difficult.
Yeah, it's hard to draw that line between business and pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you set aside how do you do it right? Do you set aside time that's like, we're gonna talk business, and then set aside time that's like, okay, now we can be cute.
No, you can't really. You can't really. I've never structured it like that, but and maybe that was the problem. But I do think you have to be careful to try to treat business as business and personal as personal. So,
well, you made a good point the other day, Anita, is that there's a disproportionately large number of lesbians who are cooking. So that made me happy.
Why, lady?
Just, just for our plight, our plight to find love. Was it difficult, you know, after having been in such a long relationship to dive back in and, you know, sort of?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's always heartbreaking to end a relationship that was that long or and that deep and committed. But I think, you know, we're both in better places now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's always a mourning period, and then then you can start to date again.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to elegantly not talk about the gods and food piece, because it's not interesting to talk about anymore. It's just interesting to talk about it in everyday life. But I think what is powerful is a good piece of advice. Everyone could use one. So piece of advice for women in food, and maybe women not even in food, just piece of advice for us to close.
I think it's important to stay focused on your goals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, try to ask yourself, you know, if you're adding to the problem at all in your views on gender and way you treat anything, asking for money, going after a job, etc.
Mm-hmm. Asking for promotion. Yep.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Anita.
Thank you.
For taking the time and schlepping out here.
Thank you.
With a little bit of time left, we're going to wine it down with Ali Buzari, culinary scientist, on wine and umami.
Wine down.
Umami and wine. So sometimes we talk about wine having savory qualities. Ali, is this like a real thing?
Umami in general is one of those things, it's one of those flavors that, especially in Western culture, we're just sort of wrapping our brains around. I mean, it was only accepted in the scientific community that it was even a thing, like, a couple decades ago, which in science world is, you know, 10 seconds ago. So anywhere where you have breakdown of sugars that are being fermented, you have possibility of making things like glutamate, which trigger umami.
Mm-hmm.
And then anything that has proteins in it can be broken down into amino acids. Glutamate is one of those as well. And all of those things definitely can happen in grapes, and the fermentation is long enough and different. I mean, one of the cool things about fermentation is that flavorful molecules are literally slamming into each other, and this whole crazy Lollapalooza of flavor is happening.
Whoa!
So
I want to be a part of that party, I always am.
Yeah. So there definitely could actually be some savory compounds in a wine.
Mm-hmm.
I think what also is playing a large part in it is the sort of extrasensory or cross-sensory input, where none of your senses, taste, smell, you know, mouthfeel, visual cues, none of those things operate in a vacuum. They all talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Science nerds like to say that flavor is multimodal, where it takes into account all your senses and your moods and your memories and your, you know, where your attention's focused.
Multimodal.
It's
that just means like a lot.
No, it's like it means like lots of input.
Yep.
Your brain is the ultimate mixing board, and you're just equalizing all these different, you know, stimuli that come in, and you're processing it in light of, you know, stuff you've done before. So,
wow.
You know, it's one of my favorite things to say is when people smell the ocean. How do you describe the smell of the ocean? What's the first word?
Salty.
But you can't actually smell salt. There are no receptors in your nose for salt. That's something you can only taste. But you associate the smell of, like, decaying kelp and all those odors with salty tastes that you've experienced before.
Like, well, that one time you took a big gulp.
Yeah, the one time you got hit in the face by a wave, right?
Yep.
You salt a pot of water to blanch some stuff. And you smell that, and it doesn't smell like the ocean. You know, salt has really no smell.
Wow.
By definition, but it's things we associate with it. So if you smell vanilla, I mean, studies have shown that actually whatever you're tasting can be noticeably sweeter, even though you've not added any sugar to anything. And so the same thing, when you have things that might be smoky or meaty or
smelling.
Savory. If you smell something that, if you smell a wine and it has any sort of nose of like Mediterranean herbs, thyme or rosemary or lavender, any of those things, there's probably a good chance that that's cueing your brain into, hey, there's something savory going on here. So that could be part of it as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
So sugars, I'm just confirming that the breakdown of sugars can also result in glutamates.
Yeah. Sugar breakdown can yield things that have umami-ness.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen a lot. It's one of those things that takes a while.
Yep.
Which is why you'll see it in older wines a lot more than you will in younger wines. And in general, older fermented things taste more umami.
Yummy full.
What is umami?
You know, the go-to descriptors are, oh, you know, it's the flavor of mushrooms and soy sauce and steak and all that.
And miso soup.
Miso soup and fish sauce and all these different things. Which, it's in there. But a lot of times in the American palate, we've just associated that with saltiness. So you really got to show them and have them have that experience. But one of the ways I really like explaining it, because I'm from Colorado, is it's stuff that you want to eat after a long day of snowboarding. Like, after you've been sweaty and cold and your muscles are burning and you feel like you're going to die for 8 hours at a time, you need really, really rich, savory things. For me, I mean, and I think most people would agree.
And a really bacony Syrah to go with it.
A really bacony Syrah. So if you're going to have, like, obviously you would ideally have something that's meat covered with more meat wrapped in cheese and, you know, whatever. But if you're going to have a salad after you're snowboarding...
then we can't help you.
No. But I mean, it would probably be like a Caesar salad with a bunch of anchovies and stuff in it. And like, in my head, that sounds okay. Because... And Parmesan and all these things. Because they're ridiculously umami-rich things. And there's no scientific correlation between snowboarding and umami. I'm just like, disclaimer. But for me, it's something that helps American friends of mine who don't have a good handle on it get a little bit more in tune with it.
Thank you.
This is Word of Mouth with Lei Ti Su on Heritage Radio Network. Tune in next week. We'll hear from Adam Fleischman, the founder of Umami Burger. He's in town from LA to judge the hashtag NY Chili Fest 2014. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.